Mr. Maven Rail 17. We were just talking about dominating no man's land and the patrolling. So, when you took over from the Americans, when did you start patrolling? Was it straight away?
I don't know if it was a CEO's idea or whether it was the divisional commander of the Commonwealth Division that stated that he wanted patrols out, he wanted his front, he wanted to have as much warning as he could of any major attack that was coming in. As I say, whether it was a divisional commander or whether it was our CEO's idea, but they wanted to know what was happening. And the best way to find out was by listening to patrols. And so we had a ring the network with listening patrols. And each company would have them out, not just big company. I suppose you're responsible for your own immediate front. And also like the reserve company, and that they had to supplement with members of fighting patrols. For all of the reserve, they weren't in reserve in the sense that they didn't do any patrol. They had men out as well. Covering areas where the forward companies couldn't cover, and maybe just help them understand too. You know, as I say, they came down to help us out, and where that night we had the coops standing too. We had some buglers who were being sent up to us, supposedly for the punishment. I don't know what they've been doing wrong, but they sent them up to us for the punishment. And, I don't know what we're going to be there, because this lad was this bugler. Was throwing these grenades left, right and centre, and they weren't going off. And the lad said, "What's the matter?" I said, "Well, don't help me, so you pull the bloody pin out first." And after that, they weren't going off. But, that's, you know, you laugh at it now. I mean, he was trying to do that. You know, the lad said, "Oh, yeah, these left, right and centre, that would happen, you know." Throwing them and getting down, more explosion, and I pulled the bloody pin on. But that was it. It was patrol, that's all we did. Some of them, you heard the Chinese, some of them, you saw them, some of them, you had a war, you know, a fight, and that was it. You got back as quick as you could. And then the next day, you know, after being a bachelor like that, you see them down in the valley kicking them dead in the wounded. Nobody used to shoot at them.
The Chinese?
Oh. And, you know, I suppose they could have seen it all right before down here. It was every packed Indian in the game, was it? Fighting like hell in the night. Everybody on the bed, and it was like, cross arm, bang, magic, go down here.
Did that happen very often? Did you actually see that happening?
No, I didn't see it, but that's it. Like, there was an unwritten law that we never threw phosphorus grenades, wet phosphorus grenades.
But you were issued with them, weren't you?
No, they were there in the weapon pits.
Were they lost or not taken out?
We never threw them. We threw the HE grenades, phosphorus. Right, when it gets in and it burns, it's terrible.
It sticks as well, doesn't it?
It sticks, and nobody, I suppose it was like during the Second World War, and I decided to use gas with it. Germany didn't use it, and Britain didn't use it. They might have had phosphorus grenades, I don't know. There wasn't any thrown at them.
Were they ever issued phosphorus grenades when you went on patrolling?
We used to take HE, I think, grenades.
Did you ever have any experience of taking phosphorus grenades?
No, I never took them out. We used to take, Mills grenades, aren't they called? Mills grenades? I used to take a couple of them, yeah. And we never took any phosphorus ones. So they weren't written wrong, I think. There was a few of those sort of unwritten laws that went from each company. Like, if a national service lad was due to come home and he had about a week to go, usually if his name came up to go to patrol, somebody would say, "I'll do it." we let him stay in, and when he'd done his work, it's hard language to go out the last night and get killed when you don't come home. And that was like somebody that was standing in with it.
And that was obviously accepted.
Well, as far as officers and that are concerned, as long as they get so many men going out on patrol, and as not, men aren't getting tired, now, you know, then for the last week or something, going out with them.
Would you have the same group of people in each patrol, or did you change around?
Usually the same ones. Usually the same ones. Obviously, you've got to go on a fighting patrol, maybe with other lads in the section, in the two sections. You know.
Was the fighting patrol the largest of the
yeah.
patrols?
Yeah.
How many men would we be talking about then?
Yeah, it's about 20, 25.
And who would normally command that?
The sergeant. Maybe an officer, but not very often. The sergeants and the corporals, and the lance corporals, nearly did all the patrol commanding. There was officers killed out on patrol and shouldn't have been out. Maybe just on was killed and should never have been out. But rather, these officers like a gung ho, you know. They're all wanting it's their livelihood, it's their living. They want another notch on the belt. You had officers obviously breaking the neck to get into the Dillons just because they wanted a career. And the next ranking would be thinking it was if they want to take the place, it'd be breaking the neck to get into them to get that experience, I suppose. I mean, not national service, and they were just breaking the neck to get out. it was in. The Billiers book, I mean, he joined us out there. He was one of our officers, the lieutenant, and he was breaking his neck to get out there. He was chaffing at the pit in Japan because he wasn't old enough to go in. And the day he was old enough, he was on the field checklist to get out. It was a theatre of war that for a the person who was making the army's career,
did the officer or the sergeant in command of a patrol, did he have a choice of the men then that he could take out with him?
No, not really. Well, he might say, I want sergeant so-and-so, or I want corporal so-and-so, or I want the red one. Well, everybody was at the same standard. No, I just want 10 bobs. I'll take 10 at all, I'll take such a section commander.
What about yourself? Did you tend to stick with your own mates than when you went out on patrol?
When you went down to the detail at the board, the names would be up for who went out, and obviously, just like everything else, and that's the way they put really close mates together, because sometimes it can be detrimental, can't it? But you would have somebody who you knew, you're all mates if it came to that, but the corporal or the sergeant would pick up. We always picked. You could only pick within each platoon. You know, if it was 10 platoon's job to do this patrolling, then you could only pick out the 10 platoon. And they maybe say, I'll just have this section, you know, and they would go out. Or if it was 11 platoon, so you only had 11 platoon to pick from. Unless they were amalgamated to go to fight patrol or something like that. But usually you're with your own foot, you never knew anybody else. You're spread out, you're little units on your own. Perhaps if you know so, never saw him. Anyway, he was just more or less in the next country, you know, but if he wasn't in your company or your platoon or section, and then when you came out the line and you were split up again, you were in different parts, you know, you were in one area, but you weren't all like yard branch within the same box and down the square. And that. But no, you got used to it, but you were still, I was still scared out of you, like, you know. But every now and again, we got each platoon being issued wirelesses. The mayor of Dunham, when the battalion went away, he started a fund. And they had bush drives and had dancers and swimming gears, and all the funds that they raised, they organised food parcels, and they organised portable radios. I mean, in those days, we weren't heard of portable radios. And each platoon was given a portable radio out of the money. You know, of course, you didn't have them in the language, but when you came out, you could also, they were big, they weren't like the little ones now, you know, they were big, and batteries now, but they were battery operated, and obviously they were Japanese. And you used to listen to them, and then you would hear them, and think, you know, slight patrol activity, you know, you've been fighting for your bloody life, like, you know, and there'd been a major battle going on as far as we're concerned, it just gave a little mention on the news, you know.
Did you ever, were there any raids on the Chinese or the enemy positions?
No, we didn't do any. There was rumours that there was going to be raids, and everybody was thinking, oh, there was no bloody raid going on, but there wasn't any. We didn't do
that. You never took part in any whilst you were in the line?
No.
And they
used, I think over the year they were in there, I think they did one or two raids. I think Colonel Green was a lieutenant then. I think he led a raid, and nothing came of it. A few lads got wounded, I think, and I say nothing came of it. They didn't capture any enemy defences or anything like that. I think one of the reasons was the Chinese were that well dug in. They were down miles and miles underground because all the bombing were interested. This and the palm that stuff to
catch near palm.
We used to watch them coming over and dropping them on the Chinese, and it never had any effect on them. They were still there the next night.
So there were no raids, no attacks whilst you were in that?
Not while I was there.
You mentioned before artillery. Who were the artillery when you were in
the
Kiwis,
line?
It was New Zealand.
And they were good. They were very good. You can picture a pretty good big hill or a mountain, wherever it is, and the artillery obviously is behind you. Now we're on the forward slope, so it's hard for a shell to drop on the forward slope. It's either got to be the high trajectory that just pulls it and then comes straight down. So the mortars, they were better because our own mortars, they could just lob them over the top. But the lines have been in the same position that long, and the mortars and the artillery had been set in the same pitch that all they had to do from the CEO or whoever was asking for artillery support would just give a reference, a map reference, and the artillery and the mortars and all, or a certain map reference was two notches on the corner, and then just they were there. You know, you didn't have to give them. They knew exactly where they were.
And it was, how quick could they bring down artillery fire in support?
You see, when, I mean, I've never been in support company, but I could imagine that, so I don't know how many 4-inch mortars we had, but say we had six, there would possibly be two would be on standby the whole time we were out on patrol and that. And as soon as you asked for something, there'd be two, which straightly would lob some over, and then the others would come in. Somebody said there was a record that could have, I don't know what it was written for, we could have 14 bombs in the air before the first one hit. You know.
Because you had 2-inch mortars, didn't you?
The infantry.
That was a smaller one, yeah.
And that was when that didn't come in. It was always the support company, the mortar. I think they were 4-inch mortars. And so when they got there, that big steel bed plates, and they set them down, and then, you know, I don't know, they've got the things, and then that's it.
So how far behind you would the mortar, the 4-inch mortars be?
Well, I'd say a cunning way, not miles, but that four rifle could be in front of them. You know, they were a way back of it, not so far, but.
And the artillery?
Still 7, they could fire 7 mile, 8 mile, so really. 3 mile back.
So they were out of sight, the artillery.
Yeah. But everything would be, and the artillery would then, all the, for their range, for their area, they would have, everything would be zeroed in. You know, the guns would be, I'm not saying cemented in, would be bedded in. And every map reference that was given to them would just be one notch or two notches on the corner and then straight away. They were very good to play.
Did they do any, how can I put it, general routine shelling of the enemy positions? Was that constant? And was that during the day as well?
Day and night.
And obviously, the, as you say, the Chinese are saying.
Useless stuff.
Would that include mortars as well?
Mortars, Some say they always just come over in threes. You know, wait for three and then run and be the fourth one. But they said wait for three, come over and go. But see, the mortars, it was. And they used to blow the trenches in, and you had to rebuild them. Put all of the rocks in that. Still had to put them back and make them safe.
Would you say that that was more or less a 50-50 exchange of artillery, or was our artillery more dominant to theirs?
I think we had the superiority in arms and stuff like that. But it was still a lot more than that, quite a nuisance.
How often was the shells landing on the on your front lines?
Quite often. How can I feel? You didn't walk along with your head above the trench, so you'd get it blown off or a shell would land. I think some of the lads who were doing some repairs during the day under a camouflage net, it was all the first day we were nice with some day and took the shirt off. And the next thing you know, some blooming mortars and shells coming and stay there and how they're in the middle of there. They'd seen the white skin through the camouflage. And so the threat was there all the time. And they used to keep a lot of them over, let you know that they were there.
Was it very effective then?
It was frightening. And of course, if it one landed in the right place, it would do some damage. It was rocky and hilly, and when the shell hits the rock, it explodes. But there's always a chance it might come down and land in a trench, and then the blast would be up and down. Land on a weapon pit and blow it all to hell, and you have to start to sandbag it up again and stuff like that.
So it was a fairly constant danger.
And the next position we were on, Yongdong, it was a canny area. The Chinese were miles away in the sense of, from what we just come off, where they were just next door. And the first time we were in, and then there was a notice came on the detail that you had to either stay in your hutching from 2 o'clock onwards, or you had to be out of the area, And then what happened was a Centurion tank rumbled up and they had a firing platform. It was just like a level up, all it would be pulled down. And they used to come up and then search the targets at what they were going to hit and fire about a half a dozen shells. Then they used to pull it off. And of course the Chinese used to try and get the tank in because we were on the receiving end.
And the tank had gone.
And one of the reasons we had to stay in the hutching was because also for the blast off the gun that used to go right down the trenches and that, when you fired the shell, with the blast and that, you had to be out of the way, but also for the incoming shell. So, that bloody tank away from me, And we used to hear them lads coming up because you used to trouble them. Somebody had been up before picking a target, so they'd get one shell and then right, and bam, 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 and then away they would go.
Would that just be ones or twos or?
tanks.
Just on its own.
On its own. and then maybe further on, another tank will be coming up somewhere else. You know, bang, bang, bang. I don't know if it's to keep them lads in business or what, but we didn't make them come up. That was the only thing.
Was that in the daytime?
Yeah.
What did you do when you were being shelled? Was there?
I just did.
There was nothing else to do.
You might have to. You scurry up and down the trenches if it was necessary. If not, you're pretty safe. Rocks and all sorts on top of the enemy. When a shell hits a hard bottom, it usually goes out the water. Unless it's pretty soft ground or something, then it sinks in a bit and then it explodes. You always had rocks and there on top, so the shell burst went out over. You were unlucky if you got caught with shrapnel because you were down below ground level, the trenches were pretty big.
So I guess really only a direct hit was going to affect
you. Aye. Or if it landed in the doorway of the hutch or somewhere like that. You know.
Did you have any experience yourself of many direct hits?
No, not where I was. No. See the aftermath of it, you know. It was just a nuisance, and of course it kept everybody. It stopped you from doing work during the day, and stopped this happening. And of course they were the same as us. They had the machine guns, and that lined up on our trenches. You know, I explained earlier on.
Yes, you explained.
Gear on flat stick lines. Yeah. Just a loose off a belt of bullets at you.
And that was a day and night thing, wasn't it?
That was a day and night thing.
What about snipers?
Never came in contact with them. Never heard of anybody being hit with a sniper.
So you never had any experience of sniping?
No.
What about from our side? Did we have snipers?
Maybe some of them, but I don't know. Never heard of it.
So you never came across any sniping at all?
No.
And you were in that front line, that first period, for roughly three to four weeks.
Yeah.
That was your first experience of...
And then we had another 3 or 4 weeks on the second time then. And then they brought you out for a short rest and then back in again, didn't they? Yeah. They were on 3-5-5 points and then went out to Yangon.
During those 3 weeks, what was the effect on men in general of the constant up all night, the constant shelling?
Why?
What sort of effects did it have on yourself and on...
And
on your colleagues.
Everybody would be affected the same. And so, everybody would be tied the same. It wouldn't be as though you could notice it because everybody would be going down together.
Were you tired?
You're sick of it. You're ready for coming out for a so-called rest. It wasn't the rest, it was just get a dog, we let Mr. Clean, and everything to do, but you got a nice sleep. You weren't getting shelled, and you got a chance to get a bath. Get a little better warm food, But it was. I suppose that's why they limited the time to being in the line on account of that, on account of the stress.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, what about stress and nerves? Did that play a part?
Some lads were nervous, Some lads were more nervous than others, you didn't know where. You always get a scary bugger. There's always some bugger. Hey there. And he unsettles everybody. And, there's always one thing, I hope he's not going out with us, but it did get you to a bit of stress and a bit nervousness, but not that I never noticed any extent of anybody going bomb happy or anything like that. People did. They did get shell shock,
Did you ever come across any shell shock?
Just when I was coming back on the boat, there was a lad. in the medical thing on the board, he was shooting himself something primitive. But it wasn't one of all that. It was somebody being brought home for the mental stress or whatever.
Did you ever come across anything like that? Anybody, any self-inflicted wounds or?
No. I reckon one of the last was trying to shoot his big toe off. But he missed. And he closed his eyes. And the bullet went round and round in the round and round inside the hutchie. I think after that, he nearly killed him himself, you know. But no, I never heard about like that. Well, in fact, well, he missed his toe, but I don't know.
That was just a story that went
round. Story went round, yeah.
So you never had any nothing like that?
No.
Never heard of any desertion or
no
cowardice, anything of that nature?
No. Everybody that I knew stood it out. No, there's nobody that even went absent without leave while we were there in Korea, absent without leave in this country, but everybody seemed to stick it out there. I never heard of that. I mean, before that, I think.
What about religion? I mean, you were priest, close to death and that's something going around you.
The priest, I'll say, and the priest came up once when we were in the line and we heard mass in a hutchie. About half a dozen, right? And that was the only time in the month. And after that, there was like a church. He would come round. He didn't get the church every time, you know. It's funny, but people, you know, I mean, they would say, lads who weren't Catholics, just say, get us a second rosary, please, will you? And get them blessed. So, yeah, I thought, no, went around my neck. They used to think nothing would happen to them if I had a pair of rosary, please, and bless them, you know. But it did them any good, you could see. We used to get them and give them, it made their mind easier. Well, that was it, you know. But now we see with us, the battalion had a padre, but he was Church of England because it's a British, it was an English regiment. Now they used to rifles, for most of them had priests. See, they had a priest for their battalion. Now we had a vicar for our battalion because predominantly Church of England. And so the priest, he did about four battalions. And each of those battalions had a vicar. That's how it worked. So consequently, the priest only visited us once or fortnight or whatever.
So you yourself were a Catholic? Were there many Catholics then in the.
Oh, there's a few. I wouldn't like to say what the percentage was, but I would say it's the same percentage as there is in the country, you know. I mean, the intake for people didn't pick him for your religion, it was just a general intake. So if it was 4-1 in the country, it would be 4-1 in the services. It would, you know, the ratio would be the same. I never saw the Church of England there in Padre. I never saw him. As I say, the priest came out of Australia. It was in the Commonwealth Commission. In Australia, the priest.
What about discipline in general?
Well,
whilst you were in the front line.
You have to be disciplined, really. It is your own discipline. Okay, every morning there was a weapon inspection. Well, you didn't have to be told to clean your weapon because your life depended on it, you know. You'd want to make sure it was going to fire and it would be clean. Everybody had to have a washing and shave every morning, and it was a sort of an inspection for that. You didn't stand to attention and, you know, it came around and had a look at you, and, you know, you had to get there as much as the shit off your clothes, you know. It was just self cleanliness to try and keep yourself clean. When you came out of the line, for the so-called rest period, that's when you probably can get back up there and take the sweat. You know, you've got a good bath, you've got a good shave, you've got your uniform or whatever you wear, and you give it a good scrub and get the mud and everything off, and clean your boots more. And that was what you did when you were out, you know.